welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we're going to be talking about Why Music Matters, the new book by David Hesmondhals from the University of Leeds, published by Wiley Blackler. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. This episode, we've got David Hesmondhals, who's a professor is it cultural policy or communication studies at the University of Leeds?
I think my official title is Professor of Media and Music Industries.
Media and Music Industries. Right. And we're going to talk about Dave's new book, Why Music Matters, which has been released this year by Wiley Blackwell. And it's out in hardback and paperback. But before we get into the book, I wonder if you could just tell the listeners a little bit about your career previous to writing the book, and I guess kind of how you came to think we needed to know why music matters.
Yeah, I'll have a go. I'm quite old now, so I've been working on, I've been a kind of media academic with an interest in popular music and music general. Since the 1990s, I used to teach in a school in Lancashire, and I decided to go back to university. In my late 20s, I ended up doing a PhD on independent record companies supervised by Georgina Bowen, an anthropologist. That was at Goldsmiths College in London. And I guess that took my interests in two directions, both towards cultural production, you know, how we come to have the culture we have, how it's produced and circulated, but also in the direction of music studies and interest in music, which I've had since I was a child. Most of the work I've done has been on either of those two subjects, really, sometimes both, on cultural production, the cultural industries, media industries on the one hand, and music on the other. So, at risk of making this too long an answer...
It's quite all right.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
You'll have to tell me, Dave, if I blab on too long. Just interrupt me. In the 1990s, I was approached by a publisher to write a book on popular music, and for various reasons, I failed to write that book.
Right.
And... I ended up writing a book called The Cultural Industries, which was published in 2002.
And which is now in its third edition?
It is. It's in its third edition, that's right. But I've carried on working on music since the 1990s, and somebody, publisher called Wiley Blackwell, approached me in around 2006 and said, we'd like you to think about writing a book on popular music. And I said that, no thanks, but I would like to write a book about music, because I increasingly felt that the issue that interested me most wasn't popular music hived off from everything else, but music is this kind of, you know, phenomenon in the world, in our lives. And at first, the book was conceived as an attempt to challenge the way that a lot of music had been thought about in cultural studies, in terms of concepts such as resistance. And what it seemed to me that a lot of cultural studies did was get the relationship between music and politics and aesthetics wrong, and thereby do a disservice to all those things, all of which I think are incredibly important. And so the book was called The Politics of Music. And as it developed, I realised that that title would give the misleading impression that I was simply reproducing the kind of heroic notion of good music, that precisely the notion that I wanted to work against, i.e. the idea that music's only interesting when it has the potential to change the world. Now, I'm very, very interested in that potential, but I think it's very, very rare that one sees that potential anything like fulfilled, if ever. And so I wanted to look at a much broader sweep of the relations between music, politics, and aesthetics and experience, really. So I wrote to the publisher and said, hey, I've got a much better title than the one that we originally envisaged that you didn't like, The Politics of Music. I think we should call it The Value of Music. And I waited for a week, and then I got a reply from the publisher saying, the marketing department absolutely nixed that title. They think it sounds too philosophical.
Which must be a bad thing in publishing.
Certainly in the marketing departments of certain academic publishers, philosophy is a very bad thing. And as you can probably surmise, Dave, I don't really agree with that view. But the tone of the email suggested that I didn't have much alternative but to accept that view. So I went to the pub with some colleagues a few days later, feeling somewhat sore, and said, complained about my troubles, as one does with colleagues in the pub. And a friend and colleague, Stephen Coleman, said to me, I think you should call the book Why Music Matters. And I thought, yeah, that sounds okay. I'll go with that. And thankfully, the publishers accepted that title, and that's what it's called.
And in some ways, actually, it's ended up perhaps sort of more philosophical being called Why Music Matters than it would have been as The Value of Music. I think it's really interesting the way you kind of deal with that question straight away in the book, because you talk about the way the book is going to be a sort of a critical defense of music. And I wonder if you could say what you mean by that idea of something as having a critical defense, and perhaps also why music needs a critical defense in the first place.
Sure. I guess the book is partly an intervention into debates about the value of culture and the value of music that have been fashionable, for want of a better term, in recent years. I think there are good reasons why we should be thinking about the value of culture and the value of music at the moment. And some of those reasons relate to the rise of a kind of what you might call economistic thinking, a way of thinking that reduces the value of things to the degree to which they serve economic development, be it education or health or culture. And so I think culture, including music, needs defending against that type of thinking, which some people would characterise as neoliberal. And some people would argue that neoliberalism has made that problem of the value of culture much more serious over the last 30 years or so. I guess a second strand of thought that I think requires us to think hard about the value of culture and of music is postmodernism. Although I think there were things that were progressive about postmodernism in the 1970s and 1980s, especially when it was tied to critiques of certain forms of class, gender, ethnic inequalities. Postmodernism, at its worst, ended up pulling the rug from under any attempt to discuss the value of culture. There was a nihilistic strain to postmodernism, certainly to certain varieties of it. So I think those are the two contexts, neoliberalism and postmodernism, you might say, for the need for a defence of culture and more specifically of music. Now, a critical defence... wow.
That was my doorbell, just ignore that. Sorry, a critical defence.
You have a life, Dave, you have visitors and things, that's great. I hope you can edit that out. The reason why I've called it a critical defence is that there are reasons to think that music can't, as has really been implied by a lot of positive appraisals of music, reasons to think that we shouldn't separate music out too much from the difficult and problematic things in the world, such as the kinds of inequalities that I've just referred to, such as the kinds of instrumentalization, the fact that in our modern societies we see increasing levels of prosperity generally, but diminishing levels, it seems, of satisfaction, well-being, flourishing, however you want to call it. Very complex relations between psychic problems, psychological problems, and social injustice. So that's why I wanted to call it a critical defence, because I think sociologically we need to bring those things in. And so it's probably worth saying, just to round off this long answer, that although I value philosophy and attempt to draw on certain kinds of philosophy in the book, the book's also sociological. It draws on cultural studies and psychology and various other disciplines. I guess it's certainly multidisciplinary. It's not just philosophical.
Yeah, it absolutely is, actually. It's really interesting the way that you kind of combine in the book aesthetic theories, theories that are associated with political philosophy, right the way through to, you know, interesting kind of, I guess, sort of analysis of particular songs and particular artists, and then stuff from more empirical projects that you've done over the last few years. And it was really interesting to see them kind of in combination to mount this this critical defence, particularly against, I guess, yeah, those two or three sets of issues, not just theoretical, but also practical in terms of a kind of unthinking defence of popular culture, and then the kind of the reduction of music's value to just pounds or dollars. To get kind of, I suppose, into the text of the book, there are four substantive chapters in which you move from, I guess, a kind of a starting point of almost the individual through relationships, couples, families, intimacy, sexuality, into a much broader kind of global point of view. And it'd be interesting to sort of take them step by step. So to start with the chapter on feeling and flourishing, could you tell the listeners a little bit about, I guess, how you begin your critical defence of music from the point of view that music might be part of and might allow people to kind of flourish or fulfil their potential, or to have increased, I guess, levels of sort of well-being, or to tie into their capabilities?
Yeah, sure. Yes, I think that idea of flourishing is important to how I see the book. As you say, Dave, it's the book's conceived at four levels. There are four levels at which I consider the value of music, at which I consider why music matters. The individual, the intimate, the core present, i.e. the way in which it enhances people's experiences of the world in terms of sociability and so on, and they're together in the same time and space. And finally, the fourth level, what I call mediated commonality, the ability music has to potentially enhance feelings of solidarity and commonality across time and space. So I begin at the level of the individual, which I suppose I should point out that that isn't to endorse any kind of methodological individualism. It's just a kind of building block, a starting point, really. But I've become more and more interested in the Aristotelian tradition of thought, and I become very attracted to the ideas about what constitutes a good life, what constitutes life well lived. And I've increasingly come to see that as a fundamental issue underlying a lot of our discussions about politics and about ethics and about how we should try and make the world a better place. So drawing on writers such as Martha Nussbaum and Amartya Sen, I try to lay out, and Andrew Steyer, the British social theorist, I try to lay out a kind of conception of human flourishing that then underpins the rest of the book. And I guess what I'm doing in terms of music is suggesting that it's music's particular relation to emotion and feeling that gives it an especially strong role to play in terms of human flourishing as a cultural form. Of course, I'm not the first person by any means to point out that music has strong relations to emotion and affect. People have been writing about that for 2,500, 3,000 years. And so that's something of a challenge, really, to try and find a way through that massive thinking and insight on music and emotion. But I guess what I wanted to do was find an alternative to the way in which different schools have approached that, different perspectives have approached that question of music and emotion. One would be the empirical social science of music, especially music psychology, which often emphasizes the kind of banal uses of music, quite right, because that's a very important part of musical experience, but maybe downplays some of the strong ways in which music evokes emotion in us, and downplays the power-laden aspects of that. On the other hand, I wanted very much to contest what's been called the affective turn in social theory, which often has Deleuzean roots, drawing on the French thinker, philosopher, Gilles Deleuze, and which, I guess for me, provides often a very caricatured notion of how previous writers and thinkers have approached the question of emotion, and dismisses emotion as a product of naive humanist thought. And I think that emotion and humanism are more complex than the Deleuzean affect theorists sometimes portray them to be.
It was particularly interesting, actually, that you come to these ideas about affect and emotion, because one of the things that chapter tries to do is combine the political philosophical questions in Nussbaum, Sen, with actually a really sort of practical focus on dancing and, like, you know, sort of, I guess, what it's like to have fun with music, which I found really interesting.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, the Nussbaum, who is, I think, a very significant philosopher in the Neo-Aristotelian school, provides one of the best accounts throughout her work, really, of the relationship of human flourishing to questions of social justice. But she also has written at some length and impressively about the relationship between art, culture, and human flourishing, and emotion. And there's, in one of her books, Upheavals of Thought, there's a discussion of music and emotion, which I think is much better than the really very strange discussions of music and emotion that you get in analytical philosophy, analytical aesthetics. But the problem is with Nussbaum's account is that it relies on a notion of musical experience that you might say is very high-minded. It kind of assumes a highly educated listener at a Mahler concert, something like that. So I wanted to bring some of the insights from her perspective, which is one that sees music as being able to contribute to human self-understanding through contact with certain emotional experiences of a particularly intense kind. I wanted to extend that from the kind of model of a highly educated listener listening to certain sorts of music in Nussbaum to a wider range of musical experiences. And there I'm drawing on, I think of it as cultural studies 101 in a way. It's Raymond Williams' basic insights from the 1950s onwards that culture is a matter of ordinary experience, not just about the best that has been thought and said, as Arnold more or less put it. I try to extend that into the world of disco records, I attempt to listen to a jungle track to think about what kinds of emotion, what kinds of experience those tracks are invoking, and link that into a discussion of the way in which people have talked about the ways in which dancing and making music and so on can enhance our lives.
It's interesting that you sort of bring up Williams because he's a figure that carries over into the third chapter of the book, which I guess broadens out from the individual experience to think about sexual relationships, love, and kind of broader emotional aspects. And in that, you try and almost in a kind of Williamsian, I suppose, would that be the word, tradition, try to do a bit of historical analysis as much as you're doing musical analysis, particularly around the way rock music has been bound up with notions of sexuality, and similarly things like hip-hop have as well.
Yeah, that's right. Well, for many people, popular music feels extremely bound up with the realm of sex. And I tell the story in the book of talking to one of my good friends, a non-academic, and saying, I'm trying to write about music and sex. And he saying to me, well, that's the whole of music, isn't it? And it seemed to him that everything important that needed to be said about music related to sexuality. And I certainly won't go as far as that, but it seemed to me important to address that question head on. And it seemed to me, too, that a lot of the ways in which that relationship have been written about are problematic. Again, to recall something I was saying earlier, they rely on a kind of heroic rock narrative. That in the 1960s, 1950s onwards, but particularly in the 1960s and the 1970s, rock unleashed human sexuality in some way. It freed a generation from the sexual constraints of previous eras. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't something in that, but I think there are considerable contradictions and problems in the way in which rock portrayed human sexuality and the way in which people devoted to rock portrayed rock's liberating role. And I'm drawing there really on critiques that developed in the 1980s and 1990s out of feminism, out of cultural studies. And in some ways, the book, that chapter partly defends certain kinds of pop music. And I guess I want to talk about the value of certain kinds of popular music that don't kind of necessarily challenge in some supposedly rebellious way prevailing notions of human sexuality so much as touchingly or beautifully remind us of our vulnerability, our reliance on others, that are particularly apparent to us in those intimate experiences.
I think it's another moment where that kind of critical defense happens, whereby you're sort of taking on both these kind of heroic models of rock musicians as kind of inventing sex in the 60s or whatever, but also you show a sort of, I guess, an ambivalence about the possibility that music can contribute positively to both sort of intimate relations, but then more broadly later on in the book, in the fourth and fifth chapters, to kind of social change and much kind of much more communal experiences. And I think there's a particularly fascinating point that you raise around, I guess, the importance of places here and things like scenes. And I wonder if you could say a bit about that.
Yeah, so this is the chapter where I tried to take on the way in which music can contribute to our lives in terms of sociability and bringing people together. The way it enhances our sense that we have something in common with those immediately around us, and of course the way in which, more problematically, it can enhance our sense of the differences between us two. Again, as you say, trying to get at that ambivalence and trying to sociologically unpick a bit where the good experiences, where the valuable aspects of music might most lie and where they might be most compromised in modern life. And I take it to a different level. If sociability is about our core presence, our being in the same same place at the same time at parties, at gigs, festivals, and so on, and music's relationship to that, then there's another aspect of core presence, which is that we live together in the same places, and that music has some sort of relationship to that too, linked to the notion of sociability, but maybe going beyond it in some way. So the sense of people feeling that they live in a good place or a not so good place, music is very important to that. And I don't think that the value of music has been conceived of enough explicitly in those terms. And there's been a lot of discussion of musical collectivities in relation to cities, to places, using concepts such as scenes. And those discussions have been interesting and often very helpful, but there's been some pretty troubling conceptual confusions going on in them. So I wanted to just move that to one side a little bit and get at this fundamental issue. What does it make? What constitutes a good musical places? And so that's what I try to address in that chapter.
And you interrogate things like, you know, questions of inequality, class, work. You know, these things come through there, but that sort of shared potential is something that you try and develop in the final chapter. I guess moving away from, as you say, things like scenes, but the possibility that music would be a kind of a space for people to connect is a way of kind of defending its aesthetic value. And this transcends place. So in that final chapter, you're talking really about kind of, you know, transnational and I guess sort of, you know, very mediated forms of music, particularly things like fandom, and how they can be the basis for things like political action.
Yes, though perhaps somewhat skeptically.
Yeah, very very skeptically
when it comes to fandom, that absolutely without. I hope dismissing it too. Yes, I guess one of the things that final chapter, which is, as you say, is on mediated community across time and place. One of the things I try to address there is the idea of the nation. It still seems to me that the nation is the ultimate test of people's abilities to live together in viable communities. And like many people these days, I'm extremely skeptical about the nation and extremely concerned about forms of nationalist discourse that serve to reinforce power, existing forms of power and inequality, and totally marginalize or exclude entire groups of people. And a wonderful example of this last week was the British newspaper The Sun had 22 million copies of some special edition of The Sun inserted through our letterboxes, an appalling celebration of a version of white Englishness that could have been written 30 years ago in many ways. It's as if, you know, anti-racist multiculturalism never happened. And
well, yeah, and for those elements, I guess, of the right, both in places like the States, in continental Europe and in the UK, they sort of wish it hadn't either. So
that's right. And so music sometimes is considered to be an important way in which those patterns of racist exclusion can be questioned. And again, stressing the ambivalence of music in the modern world, I tried to discuss a number of examples where music only seems to reinforce with a special affective power those kinds of nationalist and often racist discourse. But I also tried to show, drawing on the work of some interesting ethnomusicologists such as Martin Stokes from King's College London, that music's relationships to the nation aren't always as appalling or as problematic as, you know, the use of patriotic anthems to march young men and women off to their deaths in the First World War. Stokes' examples are from the case of Turkey. I think you can look at a range of examples, as I've tried to do using other people's work, that suggest that music can be an important way in which the differences between groups within the same nation can be eased and even at times transcended, but always with that threat that certain aspects of capitalist modernity will pull the discourse back to the reinforcement of difference, of power-laden difference.
I mean, one of the things that was a real pleasure of the book is we've been sort of discussing it for half an hour or so, and we've taken one particular line of thinking through it. But actually, there was a whole range of ways that that we could have kind of cut into the text to highlight other elements or other aspects of it. So it's a very rich book indeed, although as one would expect when it's dealing with a question as big as why music matters. As a way of kind of concluding, I always ask my guests on the podcast this about where their work's going or what projects they're working on next, which always seems a bit strange when they've just finished a major undertaking like writing a book. But are you planning to develop more along the lines of the kind of musical scholarship, or are you taking a different direction for a while? What's next for your work?
It's very nice of you to ask that, Dave. The next big thing I'm committed to doing is to write a book on cultural policy, which I know is a big interest of yours, together with my colleagues Kate Oakley and Dave Lee from the University of Leeds and Melissa Nisbet from King's College London. And that's a study based on our empirical research of the cultural policies of the new Labour government, the Labour government of 1997 to 2010. The other big project, and I do have some study lead coming up, I've been head of department for a few years, the other big biggish project that I've got on the horizon is what I'm calling at the moment a moral economy of media and culture. This is an attempt to understand the relations between capitalism and culture, which I've written about before in the cultural industry stuff, but on more Aristotelian grounds. So it draws on the kinds of Aristotelian thought that I address in Why Music Matters, but takes it in a different direction, really to challenge or in some ways complement two ways in which the relationship between capitalism and culture and media have been thought about in recent years. One is the kinds of neoliberal economistic thought that I mentioned earlier. But the other is what often gets called the political economy of culture, usually Marxian in flavour. And I have generally been very interested in the political economy of media and culture and have engaged a lot in that subfield. But I think that it has some limitations, and I want to complement some of the best achievements in political economy by drawing on Aristotelian work on economic life, not written by economists, but often written by philosophically inclined social theorists, such as John O'Neill from Manchester and somebody I mentioned earlier, Andrew Sayer from Lancaster University, whose work I find quite inspiring in its clarity and depth of thought. And I want to try and bring some of those qualities in my own way. I want to try to bring them to bear on media and culture, because that hasn't really been done before. So those are the two big projects, cultural policy and, I guess, you know, capitalism and culture through a moral economy lens. But I'm also doing bits of stuff on, I'm trying to write a paper on the question of exploitation. I've written quite a lot about work in the media work in the past, including a book called Creative Labour. I want to come back to the question of exploitation, which I think has been misconceptualized in some recent work, but remains an extremely important concept in my view. And I'm also trying to still write bits of stuff about music. I'm writing a piece on what's happened to alternative music and independent music and the idea of independent musical institutions, together with my colleague from Leeds, Leslie Meyer. And I'm also writing a piece about The Clash. And in fact, I'm talking about The Clash at a conference in Belfast on Friday, together with a lot of people who know lots more about The Clash than I do, including, you know, what drugs they were taking in 1981 and so on. So I'm slightly nervous about that, but I'll be talking about six things I love and or hate about The Clash as part of that conference.
Well, that sounds absolutely great, and it sounds like you're very busy as well. So thanks very much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. I've really enjoyed it, and thanks very much indeed for the chance to talk about the book.
You've been listening to New Books in Critical Theory with your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we were talking to Professor David Hejmondhalj from the University of Leeds about his new book, Why Music Matters. Thanks for listening.